From the Sky News Centre at 5. A former Labour MP has been sentenced to a year and a half in prison for making £22,000 of false expenses claims. David Chater has become the first politician to be convicted and sentenced over the expenses scandal. But in his former constituency of Bury North, these people reckon he got off lightly.
I think it's very lucky. It's as little as it is, to be honest with you. I think he should have had more.
18 months isn't bad.
It's no use handing out suspended sentences because it's no deterrent to him, is it?
I think a lot of other people, if they were actually convicted of fraud, would get more than 18 months.
The leaders of a gang who raped and sexually abused vulnerable girls in Derby have been jailed for a total of 19 years. A judge called Abid Mohamed Sadiq and Mohamed Roman Liakat sexual predators. Detective Superintendent Debbie Platt from Derbyshire Police says it was a disturbing case.
We were horrified very early when once we'd approached one victim who led us to another victim who led us to another victim. And as the offences unfolded, we were quite disgusted really at what we were listening to, as you can imagine.
The Food Standards Agency says it is removing any foods containing liquid eggs contaminated with a toxic chemical from UK shelves. Tons of tainted batches from Germany have been imported here, but the FSA says that low levels of dioxin mean there's no risk to public health. The Scottish Government's insisting there's been no formal request for surplus flu vaccines to be sent to England. It says civil servants have discussed availability of extra supplies of jabs, but in any case, the existing stockpile is already earmarked for Scottish patients. Football: Tottenham looked like winning the race to sign David Beckham on loan from LA Galaxy. Spurs manager Harry Redknapp says talks are going on and there's a good chance Beckham will make the move. And the EastEnders baby death storyline will end sooner than had been planned. More than 6,000 people have complained about the plot, in which Ronnie Branning swaps her dead son with Kat Moon's newborn child. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News, in association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
In Devon, on the northbound A38, just before Exeter, a crane is facing the wrong way on Holden Hill, and the road is blocked. It's affecting traffic going down the hill towards Exeter. Beware of some very slow traffic. Also, if you're using the M4 going west past Bristol, that's looking very slow on our cameras now between junctions 19 and 20, the M32 and the M5 interchange. It's down to the volume of Friday afternoon traffic. That's affecting the M32 coming out of Bristol, which is queuing between junction 1 at Hambrook and the M4 roundabout. In Gloucestershire, traffic's queuing on both the exit slip roads coming off the M5 at junction 12 on the south side of Gloucester. And if you're going south on the A419 past Swindon in Wiltshire, there's a broken down vehicle just before the Commonhead flyover. One lane is closed. If you're going west on the A40 into Herefordshire from Gloucestershire at Goodrich Cross, the A4137 junction, that's just before Whitchurch, there's a lane closed on the exit slip road while we're doing some repair work. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Wow, what a sky tonight. Hello Bristol and welcome to Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by Westbury-on-Trim councillor and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we look at the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, Colin Port. What's his past? And while nobody's perfect, why are there lingering questions about whether he's the right man for the job? Plus, formidable martial arts judge and businessman Jerry Coulter, who's fought a running battle over the last 10 years with the Freemasons. That's in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius with some rain. This weekend, highs of 9 Celsius, fairly dry and sunny, and feeling colder on Sunday over the weekend. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, getting wetter as the week progresses, may be quite windy at times too. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of January, highs of 10 Celsius, fairly cloudy but wetter Sunday week. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Westbury on Trim councillor and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. Welcome to Drive Time, Jeff.
Thank you, Johnny.
Now, tell us, what, first of all, is your day job?
Right, I'm an accountant. I advise small businesses on their accounts and their tax affairs.
And so does that take up a lot of your time? Have you got much time left for City Council work?
Oh, it's a sort of an interesting challenge to balance the time between the two.
So how much, roughly, do you spend between one and the other?
Oh, I should think I spend, I suppose, about a third of my time on City Council work and two-thirds on business work.
But don't you think maybe that the amount of time you're spending on the business work actually detracts from being a politician?
No. I'm very clear that we need our councillors being out in the real world dealing with real people on a regular basis. People who become full-time councillors end up thinking the same way as those who are employed by the City Council, and we really need people who have a different view on life.
So how do you keep councillors independent-minded from, say, council officers who've got a vested interest in the status quo?
Well, I think that's the big challenge, that if someone is attending meetings and their whole life revolves around the council, they will, it's interesting how people start to say we when they're speaking, even as a minority councillor. And in fact, I believe it's fundamental that people sort of retain their objectivity and challenge the decision-making process. And I actually believe a strong challenge makes the controlling group more powerful, not less powerful.
Now, most of the council staff are, and certainly the officers, are permanent employees. They've not got to renew a contract every year. So surely that there's a natural thing there where they actually can be quite independent-minded in what they say. They can be quite outspoken if necessary, because it's not very easy to get rid of them.
That's true. A lot of the council officers, let's be honest, do a fantastic job. There are enormous pressures and challenges in delivering the services a City Council has to deliver. But I also believe we employ people to do a job, and that job is to provide a high-quality service. And it's totally appropriate to challenge people if they're not delivering the service to the quality that's required by their job description.
Oh, OK, on to the politics now of all this. But why so friendly with the Liberal Democrats at Westminster, but daggers drawn with them in Bristol?
Well, it's interesting. I heard a comment on the television shortly after the coalition was formed by someone who was saying, if you actually, in an election campaign, you spend all the time highlighting the differences between the parties. If you actually look at the common policies, you actually find there is a very significant proportion of those policies that overlap. And so nationally, I think that's very much what is going on.
But that's not what the voters want. They want to be able to have different, completely different parties vote for one party to be different, not very similar to another party, surely.
That's always the interesting process of the electoral system, and that's exactly what people, we believed, wanted. But the fact is, the way people voted indicated that they wanted something slightly different. And I believe the art of politics is actually being pragmatic, and we need government, and we need firm government to deal with the financial crisis that this country's in. And therefore, whilst I'd have rather had a single party majority, I would rather have a coalition working together to try and restore that sort of financial confidence, which I think we all need, so that the country can prosper and flourish.
So as a party, the Liberal Democrat Party, do you think you're getting enough bangs for your buck up at Westminster with Nick Clegg?
Well, it's very interesting to see that the Lib Dems have, I think it's 28 positions in government out of something over 100. So they actually, they're getting far too many bangs for their buck in that context. I have to say, I believe the coalition is working. It's making the country governable. They're managing to make decisions. And I come back to dealing with the financial crisis, because at the end of the day, to be honest, any other policy is fairly irrelevant if we can't get the finances sorted and the country running on a sensible financial footing as quickly as possible.
So are you happy with the policy at the moment that's being pursued, the cuts and a certain amount of austerity in order to bring down the amount of government spending? Because, I mean, obviously many people are saying that this actually could be counterproductive, and less spending by the government means simply that the economy could hit another downturn.
Well, I have a very simple view that the country's finances aren't actually that different from mine or yours. And if you're spending, or I'm spending, 20% more than we're earning month on month, that is going to lead to some fairly significant financial difficulties very quickly. And the only way we can overcome that is by reducing our spending and restoring the economic balance. And to be honest, that's what's being applied to the national economy as well. There are disputes over how quickly that process should take place. But if you're overspending and you're living beyond your means, to be honest, you can't say I'll delay it until next year. It's got to be dealt with. And sadly, this was the economic situation that the government was left by its predecessor, and action had to be taken. So now I'm very supportive of it. That doesn't mean I support every reduction in spending. I believe that's got to be done carefully and with real consideration of the effects and the impact. But the general principle I do agree with.
Well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers here, and thank you for leaving us on an economics note there, because I'm sure Martin will have something to say about that. But first, I'm going to ask you, Martin, what do you think is going to be the future for the euro in 2011? Because we've already seen a few serious problems with potentially countries like Portugal and Spain dropping out of the euro, and you, I think, suggested possibly that the higher or better economies like Germany's might have to leave the euro.
Yeah, I mean, the tensions within the euro system are mounting because of the financial crisis and the collapse of the private banking system, effectively, which has been taken over by governments, which is why they've got these deficits.
Well, not all the private banks have been taken over by government, have they? Some of them didn't collapse.
Directly or indirectly, the whole banking system has been backstopped by the public sector, and that's why we've got a huge public sector deficit. But the euro has come to grief because it's a badly designed tool for the job that it's...
So why will the euro find it so difficult? Why is it badly designed?
Because you've got economies that are at very different levels of development. And historically, Greece, for example, if they were in a situation like they're in now, they could devalue their currency and remain competitive without carrying out massive internal austerity. The euro makes that impossible. But I suspect that one or the other of these countries is going to leave the euro. The Germans... The most sensible solution that's been suggested by Graham Turner, who's a city economist, is for the Germans to re-adopt the Deutschmark and let everybody else have the euro, which would mean that the euro would then fall against the Deutschmark, which would allow these countries to regenerate. Because the austerity policies being pursued, for example, in Ireland, are actually increasing the deficit, and there's going to be a general election in Ireland in the new year, and I suspect a new government's going to come to power in Ireland and they're going to leave the euro and repudiate Ireland's debts.
So what about that, Jeff? Because this is a bit of a problem. We're looking at Ireland and the evidence there seems to suggest that the austerity is going to make things worse.
Well, I think Ireland is a particularly unique case. It was well known for years that the economic boom had come to Ireland and that they were overstretching. I don't think anyone had realised quite how much they'd overstretched. So I don't think applying a comparison between Ireland and the UK economy is anything like appropriate. What I do think, however, is that Martin's comments do highlight how right politicians have been to be sceptical about going into the euro for this country, because maintaining sterling's independence has actually ensured that at least we have not been dragged down by the currency problems, and we've just been dragged down by the banking problems, and that does leave Britain capable of adjusting its finances and drawing itself out of this situation. I mean, I agree with Martin's comments. The euro is a bizarre mechanism for controlling so many diverse economies with no control over their own individual tax rates from any European bank or any European institution. And so consequently, you've only got half of the economic policy being capable of being controlled from within a country. The rest is actually controlled by the world markets. And it's one of those things where you try and develop a currency and magic it out of thin air, you end up with something that potentially is so fundamentally flawed that it could destroy and put at risk some very sound European economies.
Right, well, we've got 45 minutes now to go through 3 weeks of news review, so let's get started straight away. Austerity councils are giving lollipop ladies the push. This is in the Daily Mail, just between Christmas and New Year. Lollipop ladies are being axed by many councils as they try and save money in the face of cuts. Hundreds of crossing patrol officers receive redundancy notices before Christmas, although many local authorities authorities plan to replace salaried staff with unpaid volunteers, critics warn the cutbacks could lead to more children being killed on our roads. Colin Dowland, who's head of Dollis Junior School in Barnet in London, said, "I can't think of a single more important job than keeping children safe as they cross the busy main roads outside my school." Jeff, what do you think about this as an austerity measure?
Well, it's a prime example of one of those daft measures that people implement when they talk about cuts, and they'll look at something easy to change rather than something that might be a lot harder to change, that would require a lot of thought and planning. And this is just sheer madness. And what I'd be questioning if I was a councillor in one of those authorities as well is, have we actually looked at what we're doing with the management the next tier up? Because I suspect you'll find that most of them are keeping the same number of managers in place, but they're getting rid of the people actually at the sharp end providing the service. So I believe this is actually what gives councils a very bad name. It's the wrong decision. And ought to be seriously reconsidered.
Well, to be fair, Bristol's not on the list of where Lollipop Ladies, it does look like, will be getting rid of, but Northamptonshire, Dorset, and Essex County Council, other authorities including Peterborough, Stockton-on-Tees, Stockport and Birmingham said they would be reviewing their services in Wirral Borough Council, according to the Daily Mail. Martin, what about this as an austerity measure? Lollipop Ladies, for the chop.
I'm glad to hear that Jeff thinks it's a silly measure, because it clearly is a silly measure. I think we're having a bit of a shadow debate at the moment, because if you look at Ed Miliband's position and the position of the Labour leadership, is they are kind of agreeing with the cuts policy, but saying that it's going too far too fast. Now, I'm not in the Labour leadership, so I can say what I think. I think actually we're missing the point here. The way in which the economy actually works isn't like a household. I used to teach economics, and one of the first things you do with your A-level students is you say, take that idea and throw it in the waste paper basket, because in actual fact everything is linked to everything else. And we do not need to cut as far and as fast as we're cutting. If we're going to break out of the depression, which is what's happening, we're going into a depression, we're going to need massive government intervention and expenditure, as we did in the 30s and the 40s.
Yes, but now, Martin, where's this money going to come from?
That's a very good question. First of all, the first point is that you do want to run a deficit in a recession. That's actually quite a sensible thing to do, as long as it's...
Surely that's just going to make things worse.
No. In a recession, in the 1930s, the US started to run a budget deficit to break the back of the depression. That's what we will have to do this time on a global basis. But you can't just run a deficit. You've got to have fiscal consolidation. You've got to try and make sure that that your books balance. Now, the logical place to get that money, if I can just finish, is from those sections of the society which have done very well out of neoliberal privatisation and globalisation. Some people have done very well out of all of this, but it's what the von Hayek would call malinvestment. The profits aren't real, so the profits aren't in fact real profits. They're actually social profits. They've got to be taken back and reinvested in the economy. The wealthy classes won't like it, but it's a national emergency, as they themselves say.
But you, I'm afraid, Martin, if you try and pursue that policy, you're going to end up with taxation just being used purely to pay the interest on the debt, aren't you?
No, because the point about fiscal consolidation is you want to get your deficit down to the level where you're not in fact getting into an interest rate trap, and I totally accept that, but that means we've got to have a hard discussion about who gets what in our society. And as we're watching the bankers give themselves bonuses when the private banking system has already cost £1 trillion to the British taxpayer, this is all arsy-versy. And when the deficit increases, and I notice it did increase in November despite what's being said by the government, I suspect that by the end of 2011 we will have lots of pain out there, but the deficit will be bigger. And that's exactly what's happened in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland and in Greece. And it's not to do with specifics of those countries, it's to do with the way the economy actually works.
Okay, Jeff, I want to give you the final word on this one.
Thank you. It's good to have something we can disagree on. Martin, I was taught economics, and the one thing I learned when I was being taught economics is that however many economists you talk to, you will always get more different opinions than the number of economists in the room. And whilst the theory about a deficit in a recession can be sound, the problem is that when it follows a period of deficit in a boom, which is totally irrational and illogical and is the extravagance of 12 years of Labour government, the fact is that some basic household economics then come into play. Because if you've spent the reserves at times when you should have been accumulating them, you have nothing to fall back on. And that, sadly, is the reason why we're in the economic mess we are. I think we've also got to be very careful that the policy of taxing those that can afford it sounds wonderful in theory, but if in fact we alienate and demoralise those who are capable of creating wealth and creating jobs in this country, then actually the probability of a long-term depression is significantly greater. It was proven before when tax rates fell from 60% down to 40%, the tax take increased because more people were prepared to work harder, earn more and generate more income. As you put tax rates up, you will in fact find the tax take falls, and therefore the deficit will grow. So actually what we've got to do is encourage people to work hard and allow them to retain some of what they earn so that they have the pleasure of spending it.
Okay, on to our next story now. And despite all the hard work by police, there's been a surprising amount of criticism of Operation Braid, Avon and Somerset Police's 60 officer investigation into the murder of Joanna Yates, which has made news around the world. Maybe it's just the media looking for a new angle that isn't there, but last week Joanna's family accused the police of keeping them in the dark, afterwards stressing their support for the police. There was criticism the police did not check some potentially crucial CCTV footage, allowing it to be over-recorded and potentially crucial images lost. There's also the strange announcement that two people spotted on CCTV apparently following Joanna home on that fateful Friday evening, the 17th of December, were probably just passers-by. On Tuesday this week, ITN filed a report with criminologist and former police officer Mark Williams-Thomas, which was critical of Operation Braid. On Wednesday, Avon and Somerset banned ITN from their press conference. The ban was subsequently lifted. Here's Radio 4's media show presenter Steve Hewlett talking to editor-in-chief of ITN, Dave Mannion, on Wednesday.
The last few minutes, it has emerged that ITV News has been banned from press conferences by the Avon and Somerset police, apparently because they didn't like something ITV News broadcast last evening. This is part of Geraint Vincent's report.
There are more flowers by the roadside now and more reasons to wonder whether this inquiry has followed procedure.
I would have expected to come along here and seen absolutely nothing. Certainly nothing that could DNA could be taken from. There's a bottle there, there's another bottle there.
The piece featured an interview with a former police officer, Mark Williams-Thomas, who was critical of the police inquiry thus far. The police have now, they told us that they had now made a complaint to Ofcom in respect of what they describe as unfair, naive and irresponsible reporting. Well, I'm joined by Editor-in-Chief of ITV News, Dave Mannion. Dave, many thanks for joining us. What do you make of the Avon and Somerset Police's suggestion that your reporting was unfair, naive and irresponsible?
Well, see, first of all, could I take this opportunity to offer my condolences to the family, particularly the parents of Jo? What we're dealing with here is the murder of a young woman. And the most important thing is to find the perpetrator of that heinous crime. So I'm sad that we're having to have this conversation at all. But there is an issue which goes beyond the accuracy of one report. It's about the freedom of the press, and that is presumably why you invited me on today.
Well, what do you make of their suggestion that your report was unfair, naive and irresponsible?
Well, we stand by our story, but I also stand by the procedure which the Chief Constable has now done. If he has a complaint, there's a route to take that complaint. He could write to me, or, as he has done now, he could write to the regulator complaining. And if Ofcom decide to uphold that complaint, we will respect its findings. In the interim period, we cannot have a situation where legitimate members of the press are summarily banned from press conferences, which we are legitimately entitled to be at. And that's what happened this morning before the complaint to Ofcom was made.
Did you approach the police for comment before the item was broadcast?
Yes, we did, Steve. Of course we did.
And what did they say?
Well, I don't know what they said because they didn't answer. We made numerous attempts to speak to them yesterday evening from 5 p.m. onwards. I don't know how many times we called various people, but it was something between 8 and 10. We didn't get a single response at all. In the light of that, I think this is quite important. Our reporter then caveated the report by saying, and I quote, "There may be good reasons why certain routine inquiries may not have been followed."
Okay.
So we put in the caveat because we could not get a response, despite numerous attempts to do so, from Avon and Somerset Police.
That was Radio 4's media show presenter Steve Hewlett talking to editor-in-chief of ITN, Dave Mannion, on Wednesday this week. Jeff, first of all, you, I mean, obviously, the police are doing a hell of a lot of work here. Do you think it's unfair, really, for ITN to be critical of them in their report?
I do, to be honest. I think that whatever anybody's views may be of how the inquiry's been handled, one has to recognise that there is no doubt the police are doing the very best they can to solve it. And I think if there's any criticism, it should be given privately. I think open public criticism at this stage is actually undermining the work they're trying to do. And I think the majority of the public would want to support them in that very difficult and painful job.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this story?
Well, obviously the first thing one wants to say is what a horrific crime this is and how it's upset everybody and how sorry we are for the families and everybody that's been affected by
it. I think
it.
Particularly because the body was actually discovered on Christmas Day itself. Yeah. It's absolutely horrific, isn't it?
I mean, we know, sadly, that I mean this isn't the only murder that's happened in Bristol in recent weeks. I mean, but it's obviously captured the public's attention nationally. I wouldn't like to second guess a police investigation. I think, you know, that's what they're there for, is to do their job. I think, to be fair, I think you've got to accept that people must be able to make criticism without being punished by the police. I mean, the police can answer the criticism. You know, the ITN have criticised them. The police can say, well, yes, we don't feel that's fair criticism. But you can't ban people from press conferences. That's, you know, that's not the way to go. There's got to be, you know, you're going to have to take criticism. Perhaps it's unfair criticism, and in which case you say that's unfair. But I'm afraid these things do have to be transparent, and perhaps the ITN are being unfair here, but nevertheless they have a right to be unfair. It's for the police to point that out if that's what's going on.
And I'd just also like to read out something from the police on this subject. They did actually put out a press release saying, "The media are a crucial partner in helping us to catch those responsible for killing Joe. We value their contribution in reaching out to our communities, informing the public and appealing for witnesses and information. The media have generally reported in a balanced and measured way, but when they cross the line and endanger the integrity of a live murder investigation, we must act. Our primary aim will always be to secure justice for Joanna. We respect expert critical reporting, but naive, unbalanced and irresponsible reporting does not help. The withdrawal of the invitation to ITN to attend the press conference was one made because of the manner and inaccuracies in their 10 o'clock news report on Tuesday evening, but this has now been counterbalanced by a much more accurate and measured piece of journalism at lunchtime. As a result, we've decided that ITN are welcome to attend future press conferences, but we will not hesitate to adopt similar tactics again if we feel any media organisation hampers our investigation." And just a reminder, the Operation Braid number is 0845 456 7000. If you have any information about the murder of Joanna Yates, 0845 456 7000. More after six. And police apparently smashed up, this is the next story, a one-stop shop for London gangsters. Scotland Yard's largest ever simultaneous raid has led to the jailing of 33 gang members, including a 7-7 fireman who was awarded for his work on the bus bomb, actually on the day of the 7-7 London bombings. Police have forced their way into a property as part of something called Operation Eaglewood. 33 criminals linked to the operation were sentenced to more than 200 years in prison, and reported restrictions were just lifted a couple of days ago. Martin, do you want to start on this one? This is an incredible operation, isn't it, that was going on here, money laundering right under the noses of the Metropolitan Police through what looked like a proper business.
Well, this is how money laundering takes place. I mean, as I've said before on this programme, during the 2008 banking crisis, the UN Office on Crime and Drugs issued a report pointing out that the banks had basically sucked up huge amounts of illegal money as the crisis developed, and there was a big sucking sound, and most of the illegal money that had been hanging around was sucked into the banking system. I think one of the fundamental problems we've got is that the illegal drugs market creates a whole parallel economy. It's a huge market, probably bigger than many other legitimate markets, and it's very difficult to stop it, the money from it leaking out into the wider economy. In fact, it's become essential to keeping the mainstream banks in operation. Now, we've got to stop and step back and have a look at this. There is actually an NGO based here in Easton called Transform, which has been campaigning for the legalisation of drugs. I think this is an issue that has to be discussed. I mean, it was brought up by an ex-Labour cabinet minister, his name has now escaped me, and Ed Miliband immediately slapped him down. I think we need to have an adult debate about this, because the illegal drugs market is becoming... it's like the illegal alcohol market in the 20s. It's becoming the basis for a criminalisation.
So are you saying that the drugs are not a problem? People can take as many drugs as they want, so long as they're not coming through an illegal route.
Drugs are a problem. Nobody's suggesting that. I mean, smoking's a problem, but we don't ban people from smoking. We regulate it and make it difficult for people to get addicted, and we try and help them if they are. And I think that is the rational policy, frankly.
Only after the raids, we were told by The Guardian, Vikram Dodd, did investigators realise what an important role Ford played in the gang network. He was caught red-handed at his flat in Chertsey, Surrey, as he divided more than 100 kilograms of cocaine worth around £5.5 million into bags. His medal for his work on the 7/7 London bombings glittering on a display table nearby. Now, this is pretty horrific, isn't it, Jeff? Do you think, how widespread do you think this kind of thing is, this kind of organised crime going on under the noses of the police?
I think we'll never know quite how widespread it is, but it does seem to me there's a lot more going on out there than we'd like to think. And it does surprise me that it's able to continue. Perhaps this is highlighted quite how important it is to get to those at the centre of these money laundering and gang operations, because actually dealing with those at the smaller end of things may take out one supplier in one small community, but unless one can take out the gangs that are bringing the drugs to the streets in the first place, it's going to carry on in all the rest of the locations that their suppliers are operating in.
So as an accountant yourself, how easy do you think it is to detect money laundering by going through the books of a company or a business? I mean, this was a taxi firm, apparently.
I can't tell you how easy it is to detect, because I've never had the chance to detect it, but I can perhaps tell you that it would probably be relatively easy to conceal, if you have a mind to do it that way, and you simply need a frontage and an apparent form of trade, and particularly now with some businesses having a massive amount of internet trading, it is very possible for people to claim that they don't have many customers through the door because they have an internet operation. And it can be very, very difficult to disprove that. And certainly based on what I have read of some of the scams that have operated, people will go to enormous lengths to create transactions that appear to produce a valid business. And the police need a very significant amount of resources to be able to actually detect those and put an end to them, because they're very sophisticated. And the problem is, if you don't have all the work applied to prove it, those guys are going to run rings around any prosecution.
Of course, the other thing is that some of these big organised crime gangs have got fantastic amounts of money to try and at least bribe their way out of trouble if they think trouble might be coming their way. This network's tentacles, apparently, Vikram Dodd says, stretch to Colombia, Spain, Israel, India, Dubai, Morocco and other North African states. Quite incredible, really. Others linked to the gangs included a convicted murderer, bodybuilders and a Cambridgeshire drug dealer, Russell Tate, whose brother Patrick was shot dead in a Range Rover.
Can I just mention Colonel Oliver North, who was in the 1980s, was a US government employee, and it was the Senator Kerry's committee investigated what he'd been up to with his CIA chums, and they were bringing in thousands and thousands of tons of cocaine into the United States and selling it on in order to provide a slush fund for their terrorist war in Nicaragua. There has long been a clear linkage between Western intelligence agencies and drug dealing. Colonel Oliver North, we're talking about kingpins, he should have gone to prison for 30 years. He didn't go to prison for 30 years. He was given a pardon by George Bush Sr. and he's now a national hero on the right wing in US politics. Now that is the problem. that the drug money is so well stuck in to our power structure that the intelligence agencies and the banks are the major players. Now, we're going to take down the CIA and the banking system, then we might be able to get something done about drugs.
Jeff, do you think there's any chance that David Cameron and your friends up at Westminster will be able to make a dent in some of these big, powerful organised crime gangs? Or at least encourage the police to. I'm not expecting David to do it himself.
I would love to believe that that was going to be the case. It does come back to the financial pressures that there are at the moment and whether there are enough resources available to put into it. But if we don't, then I believe a lot of the fundamental values that exist in society today are going to be challenged. And I think that would be for the worse if we don't bring it under control.
So under the watch of the Conservative Party?
I would like to think so.
Okay, just also remind everyone that there's a loan shark problem, we're told, will get worse in the southwest as we're talking about this kind of thing. The illegal money laundering lending team, not laundering, in the southwest has reported a daily increase in call rates. The news of loan sharks is increasing and going to get worse, according to experts in the southwest. The Bristol-based illegal money lending team claims it's already a serious problem across the region. The only trouble is that as part of the cuts, the Southwest's illegal money lending team covers the region from Gloucester to Cornwall. However, the government has announced, that's your government, Jeff, from March 2011, it will be scrapping the regional teams and moving to a structure that will see a Birmingham-based team cover the whole of England. Now, this is crazy, isn't it?
On the face of it, it doesn't sound the best proposal. I don't know enough about how that Birmingham operation is going to be funded. We have to get a happy balance here that there is some benefit in a national approach, because some of what's going on here is practices being used around the country that different local authorities, different teams are having to deal with. So I can actually see some real benefit in there being a centralised approach, but what it does actually need is still enough staff in the operation to actually be able to carry out their work and stop this. I mean, there are horrendous incidents, and it's those who are most vulnerable that are being exploited by the loan sharks.
But if they're closing down our local loan shark unit, surely the loan sharks themselves are going to be laughing.
Well, I not necessarily, because I believe if the same number of people are available to monitor and control the situation, potentially it could be better. A lot of the loan sharks are operating on wider than small localities, and therefore this might actually give a better chance to control it. I still need to be fully convinced, but I think it could potentially be more effective.
Now we're joined by Marina Morris, who's been looking at the prices at the petrol pump of petrol and diesel. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Now the price of fuel is at a record high. The total increase in price per litre since this time last year is an average 17.7p. The price of road fuel has increased twice in the last week, as a fuel duty and then VAT were increased. On the New Year's Day, a government fuel duty increase put another 0.76p onto a litre of both petrol and diesel. And on 4th of January, the rise in VAT from 70.5% to 20% resulted in another price rise. There are a few essential topical questions around road fuel. Is it a fair policy to increase these taxes on oil, and what is the impact for the consumers? Is it a fair that commercial pressure stress the ecology and risk the foundation of our well-being? And how safe is the oil trade? A committee of MPs recently has raised serious doubts about UK's ability to combat oil spills from deep-sea rigs following the BP Gulf of Mexico oil disaster last year. They also warned that taxpayers could pay for a major spill in the North Sea, but they said a moratorium on deep-sea drills would undermine the UK's energy security and is unnecessary. We depend on the ecology of our planet and need to learn how to flourish as humans within finite ecological limits. In 1972, a book, The Limit to Growth, was published predicting the future for mankind, that the world would begin to run out of key resources within a time span of 80 to 100 years if current trends continued with no major changes. The computer-generated models used appears to have reasonably predicted the fundamental of today's world. The book presented three main choices for alternative futures. First, we can continue to grow our economies until resources run out, at which time population and industrial capacity will crash. The second, changes could be made moving the economy to ecological stability, which could be maintained far into the future. And this, the third conclusion was, the sooner the world moves towards the second path, the greater the chance of achieving it. It was a prediction of the book The Limits to Growth. Let's get back to the record price of fuel. What do the people of Bristol think about the fuel tax rise? The price of road fuel is twice in the last week. Are car drivers happy to pay the extra cost?
I would say no, but then there's a little, you've got no choice, have you, because you need to use the fuel. People will take measures to reduce using their vehicles and only use it for priority trips. That's what I would do personally anyway. It's not really fair now, because you've got the world price of oil has just gone up again, and then when you add on the tax as well, it just makes it so expensive now, doesn't it, really?
I personally am, because I think we do need to take account of the car culture and anything that will encourage people and councils to provide better public transport, then I think we should be in favour of.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. It's gone up by a stupid amount of money, and I don't think people are going to be happy with it.
Yes, I think it's fairer because of the environment. And in order to raise taxes, we have to raise it some way, and it's a good way of maybe making people have public transport or using bicycles. It's better than income tax rises.
No, not at all. It's unfair for the ones that are privileged enough to own a car, but they're getting taxed heavily for it.
I don't think it's fair, because ultimately it impacts on poorer people more. I mean, everyone probably drives as much as each other, but obviously if you have less money and you're paying out more, it's going to impact you more, so it's not fair at all.
What has happened to consumer power?
I'd say it's dwindled a bit, really, because you can't really shop an alternative cheaper route. I mean, the supermarkets try and drive the costs down, but some of the more independents will probably disappear because the supermarkets govern the lower prices. But although the price of high remains high, I think ultimately you're going to see a swing more to the supermarkets because they are that fractionally cheaper.
Yes, I think it can, but it depends on the nature of the commodity.
In the current climate, I don't think so. I think the country's so debt-laden that consumer power is out the window at the minute with inflation and...
Only with competition, but if you put the price of fuel up, then it will be the same everywhere, so consumers cannot really affect the price. They can only really affect the price by shopping elsewhere with competition.
I think we just need to get together and try and protest in many aspects, really. More come together.
With certain things like, you know, utilities like gas and oil and electricity, consumers don't really have any power there because they're monopolies, and so the companies can charge what they like. So maybe in certain kind of areas of consumerism...
Should we be prepared to go to war for oil?
Wars aren't always an answer, are they, unless they're sort of a severe threat to if there's an occupying power doing it purely out of malice. But no, I would say no, it's not right to go to war for oil, really.
No, because I think we should be concentrating far more on alternative energy sources. We need to wean ourselves off from our dependence on oil.
No, I don't think you can. It's an expendable resource. I think we should be looking for new renewable energies that are endless in their life.
No, we shouldn't, no. We should not have war just based upon our own well-being. Definitely not, no. we should not go to war for oil.
Yes, yes, we should. I think it would be a great option.
Well, the idea of going to war for oil is obviously a horribly unethical thing. And this idea of protecting fuel, I mean, these fuels aren't renewable anyway. The future lies with renewable energy, renewable fuels. So I think whilst arguably things like nuclear power not renewable, I think nuclear power is quite a good way of moving forward. I know it's not entirely renewable, but it's kind of more efficient, certainly, than burning coal and oil.
Marina Morris there out on the streets this week asking you what you think about the recent massive hike in fuel prices. And as she said before we heard the Vox Pops, 18 pence a litre. This has gone up in the latest, in the last year, which is, what, more than 15-16%. Anyway, Jeff, so do you think people should be paying more for their fuel? In a way, we're being told, aren't we, that driving our cars is bad because it causes global warming. So is this is it a good thing or is it a bad thing that we're having to pay more for our fuel?
Well, I don't think anyone's going to say it's actually a good thing, but I think in terms of recognising the cost of the pollution that follows from what we use, then it is appropriate that fuel prices go up. It should ensure that people do reconsider whether that is the best use of their money in buying that fuel and running that vehicle.
Because it's not really a free market, is it? Because we've got the government is actually increasing VAT. You know, David Cameron's decided he wants to increase VAT. Yep. Quite a lot of the increase in duty is a government part of it.
But you see, we have a very confusing situation in terms of tax on cars, because past governments, as well as the current one, actually take a great deal of tax from the car manufacturers. They, on the one hand, want people to produce powerful cars because they take more tax, but on the other hand, don't want those powerful cars because they pollute more. Now, I would very much like to hope that by the gradual increase in fuel price, it will encourage people to recognise the benefit of greener motor vehicles, because that is the one way they can, if they do need to travel, can keep their motor costs down. So I would say, be very positive, that this could be a real incentive to look at low CO2 emission cars.
Martin, is it really a free market? So why has the price gap been going up nearly, as Marina was telling us, 18 pence in a year?
Yeah, well, one of the problems is, A, there's a supply and demand issue because there's more demand for oil in the economies, which are still forging ahead, like in East Asia.
I mean, you would expect our economy to be less demand for oil since the economy is being slightly depressed.
Well, the effect of this will probably be deflationary. In the 70s, oil price increases fed through as inflation. I think this will feed through as deflation because people will actually buy less oil because they won't have any money.
But they need to go backwards and forwards to work, don't they? Well, yeah. Oil is one of those things that you actually do need.
Yes, but at the same time, the fact that you've got to pay for the oil means that you've got less money to spend on other things, which will then have a knock-on effect on the economies. That's what I'm suggesting. The other thing that's going on is that because of the way we've structured our financial markets, commodity bubbles are now being basically encouraged by the way we've set things up. I mean, this is all human will that's created this. It's not an act of God. And a lot of the quantitative easing money, which has been sloshed into the system, has ended up pushing up things, not just oil prices, but things like copper prices and so on. It's what some people call bubbleomics. And of course, what you do if you're a hedge fund manager or whatever, you put your money into something like copper, you ramp the price up, and then you leave just before it crashes.
So are you saying with a shed load of money? Some of this increase may be due to speculation, as people have taken their money out of the stock market, for example, and use it in commodities.
Exactly. We're not investing in infrastructure and human capital. The money's got to go somewhere, so it goes into these speculative bubbles.
Okay, would you like to have a final word on that, Jeff? Because this is really a conservative thing, isn't it? You want to have a free market, so that has actually, well, as Martin's saying here, is actually contributing to increases in the fuel prices because people are speculating with petrol and fuel.
That, I think, is one of the problems of the global economy now, and it's the same with currencies as well, that in fact a vast number of the transactions in currencies are taking place by people who are speculating. And that is something that the regulators around the world haven't really come to terms with, and it is going to be a growing issue, because the speculators have the ability more than ever to break many small countries, and sooner or later that is going to bring about some very severe financial problems. So really what we do probably need to look at is how regulation works, not within each country, but on transactions between countries.
Okay, the next story, workers' anger at knighthood for boss. A New Year honour was given to £11 billion Cadbury seller and gas monopolist Roger Carr, chairman of Centrica, which put British gas prices up 7% in November. This was in the Evening Post. Union leaders at the former Cadbury's factory in Keynsham have expressed outrage after the man who oversaw the firm's sale to Kraft through money from the Royal Bank of Scotland, which was our money, was given a knighthood for services to British industry. 600 workers lost their jobs earlier this year after the chocolate firm was sold to the American Food Corporation. The firm revealed yesterday the last chocolate bar has rolled off the production line, and now a skeleton staff of around 50 workers are all that remains as the Somervale factory is dismantled. Now, this is pretty shameful stuff, isn't it? I mean, we desperately need big local employers like Cadbury's, and it looks like this plant is now pretty much mothballed.
I think it's probably worse than mothballed. I think a large chunk of the equipment has already been dispatched to other countries to in the process over there.
So why give the guy who's organised this a knighthood?
Don't ask me. He wouldn't have been on my list. I can safely say that for that very reason. But actually, this brings up a whole wider issue, not unlinked with our previous comments about regulation. The last government allowed foreign investors to come in, take over Cadbury's, take over British airport authorities, for example, and create this debacle we had at Heathrow before Christmas. And I do firmly believe in the free market, but I also believe the free market needs regulation and control. And one has to also look at a situation now that we're European and say, would the French allow their chocolate manufacturer or their airports authority to be taken over by foreign owners? And I'm all in favour of following the same approach the French would have done, and the answer is no.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think there is you know, there is common ground here between us about this. I think that the philosophy was pursued by the previous Conservative governments and by the new Labour government was that we're completely open to business. Anybody can buy any of our stuff. So we had the bizarre situation of privatisation of British electricity industry. It led to the state electricity industry in France buying up chunks of our electricity. So it's still owned by the state, but by the French state rather than by the British state. I think that there's definitely a role for the Conservative Party to take a more sceptical line on the free market. I mean, I think that's very much in the national interest. But I think there are others in your party who wouldn't necessarily agree, Jeff.
Is that right?
I think there are some who are so committed to the free market that they may not challenge. But I think it's widely accepted by a goodly number of people within the party and beyond that one proper self-regulation is absolutely fundamental, because otherwise the free market may be abused by those who will manipulate it entirely for their own benefits based on their inside knowledge or their specialist knowledge.
But surely self-regulation, you're kind of just crossing your fingers behind your back, aren't you, and saying, oh, well, let's hope that they regulate themselves. That's not good enough, surely.
Well, self-regulation, I'm saying there in the context that the country needs regulations that protect either key businesses for this country in terms of the airports authority, for example, or those that employ a large number of local staff. And I think that is, so perhaps self-regulation isn't entirely what I'm suggesting, but we need national regulation that protects. And that's protecting the business, protecting shareholders, but also it's protecting jobs, because at the end of the day, we have precious few manufacturing jobs left in this country, and we need to make sure that we maintain a manufacturing base. Otherwise, I shall need Martin to be explaining to me how in any economy that doesn't produce anything, one can ever create a gross domestic product.
Can we, Martin, in a country that doesn't produce...
Well, I think what Britain led the world, both under Conservative and New Labour governments, in pursuing the free market dream. And I think it's incumbent on Britain to start waking up from the nightmare that it's become. And I welcome the fact that we're having a sensible dialogue about this, because I think in the 1950s, for example, Harold Macmillan's memorandum to Margaret Thatcher has just come out after 30 years under the Freedom of Information legislation, and he was giving her, you know, in a fairly severe dressing down about her policies. And with hindsight, of course, I think Macmillan was entirely right and Thatcher was almost entirely wrong, and the Conservative Party used to understand these things. There was a wide consensus about this, that the free market absolutely has to be regulated, because unless it's regulated, you end up with a free-for-all, which isn't a free market. It's a war, basically, against the weak.
OK, on to our next story. The Liberal Democrats have blocked Bristol City Council's rethink on green spaces last night at a meeting at the Bristol City Council. And I imagine you were there, Jeff. Maybe you could just give us a report on this. What happened? What we've heard is that the Parks sell-off plan, which is a consultation organised by Lib Dem Gary Hopkins, there was an attempt to delay the implementation or the selling off of this until the Conservative group and the Labour group were saying that it wasn't actually done completely and properly, because there was an unprecedented amount of public input, and not all of this public input can possibly have been gone through in the short period of time at the end of the last year. So were you there? Let's have a report if you were.
I wasn't there, but I've had a full report on what happened from my colleague who was at the meeting. And start off by trying to explain the rather peculiar way the City Council works in this issue. The Cabinet, which is made up of members of the controlling Lib Dem group, makes all the decisions for the running of the council, and they make those formal decisions at a cabinet meeting. If members disagree with the decision, they have the ability to call it in, and that means referring it back to a subcommittee, and they can call it in on a number of grounds. And one of the main grounds is that there's not been proper consultation. The argument that was being put forward this time was that there had been a lot of consultation, but that in arriving at the decision, the Cabinet had ignored the views of very many thousands of people who had made clear that they did not want the green spaces sell-off to go ahead. And I'm afraid this whole process makes a mockery of the current local government management system, which actually means that all you have to do is consult on any policy, and even if every single resident in Bristol was against it, you've ticked the box because you've asked them what their views were. And the Cabinet is then free to go ahead and do it.
So have we heard the last from the Conservative group on this Parks and Open Spaces sell-off programme of Gary Hopkins?
No. We will continue to challenge this decision in any way that we can to ensure that, if at all possible, this very unpopular decision, an illogical decision, is challenged and turned around.
Well, Gary would say what they've done actually is that they've clarified which bits of land are going to be sold off over the next 20 years and which aren't. And that was the reason for doing it in the first place, is just to make it clear to people this bit is earmarked to be sold off over the next 20 years and this bit isn't.
That's right. But the original consultation was on whether people wanted to sell off poor quality parkland. And the thought was that the residents as a whole would prefer to have a smaller area of better quality parkland. And what's come out absolutely categorically unanimously from this consultation is that people would prefer to have, if they're given that choice, they would prefer to have the parkland they've currently got, even if it's not the best quality, than to lose it. Because what's become apparent from the consultation, that the nearest green space to an individual is extremely valuable to that individual, whatever the surveyor might tell you that land is worth. And sadly, the Lib Dems have decided that they're going to sell off the land, most of the land they'd originally thought of selling off, anyway. And the fact that people are opposed to it has totally pass them by. And I have to say, as a politician, what I find strangest of all is I can't see why they are confronting the public on this issue, because they're normally a party that talks to the grassroots and champions them and claims it's their strength. And this time they've listened to the public and said, no, we're going to take any notice of that. We're going to do exactly the opposite. Leaves me totally baffled.
So can you think of any reason why they might have done that, the Lib Dem group? I mean, sure, this is what Gary is saying, is that he just wants clarification over which bits of land can and which bits can't be sold.
I think they're doing it because Gary's made up his mind that's what he's going to do.
Okay, well, that's certainly an interesting answer. We're coming up now nearly close to the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Councillor Jeff Gollop, who's leader of the Conservative group here on Bristol City Council. After the news, we look at the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, Colin Port. What's his past? And while nobody's perfect, why are there lingering questions about whether he's the right man for the job? Plus, formidable martial arts judge and businessman Jerry Coulter. That's in the second hour after the news.
Voice, and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol